I think probably a better topic for this, rather than maintaining a life of purity, is striving toward a life of purity. I know that I certainly can't say that my life is pure. It's something that I strive for and try to be obedient to God, and I'm sure that all of you are dealing with the same battles that I do. And so I want to share a few things with you that I've gotten from some different sources. There's not really a whole lot here that I've thought up on my own. Most of it is what I have gotten from people that are smarter than myself. And so I'll be sharing some things. And then Keith, my son, will be sharing a little bit later on kind of a perspective from a younger man and some insights God has given him on the issue of dating. But it seems like most of our problems in the area of purity are in dealing with the opposite sex. If it wasn't for them, we'd all probably be doing pretty good. Is that right, Jeff? So, one of the things I thought I'd start off with, sometimes it's kind of strange where you find some real wisdom from, and I had gotten over the email a while back, kids' wisdom about love, and some questions posed to a group of kids aged 5 to 10, and some of them, they hit it pretty well on the mark. Under the question, what's the proper age to get married? Tommy, age 5, says, once I'm done with kindergarten, I'm going to find me a wife. What do most people do on a date? Well, Mike, age 10, says, on the first date, they just tell each other lies, and that usually gets them interested enough to go back for a second date. When is it okay to kiss someone? Jim's got this figured out. He said, you should never kiss a girl unless you have enough bucks to buy her a big ring and her own VCR, because she'll want to have videos of the wedding. So he's figured out what kissing a girl gets you into. Great debate. Is it better to be single or to be married? Kenny, age 7, says, gives me a headache to think about that stuff. I'm just a kid. I don't need that kind of trouble. Concerning why love happens between two people, Jan, age 9, says, no one is sure why it happens, but I heard it has something to do with how you smell. That's why perfume and deodorant are so popular. And what falling in love is like. Leo, age 7, says, if falling in love is anything like learning to spell, I don't want to do it. It takes too long to learn. The role of good looks in love and romance. Gary, age 7, says, it isn't just always how you look. Look at me. I'm handsome like anything, and I haven't gotten anybody to marry me yet. Concerning why lovers often hold hands, David's got this figured out. They want to make sure their rings don't fall off because they paid good money for them. Confidential opinions about love. Regina, age 10, says, I'm not rushing into being in love. I'm finding the fourth grade hard enough. Some surefire ways to make a person fall in love with you. Bart, age 9, has got this sorted out. One way is to take the girl out to eat. Make sure it's something she likes to eat. French fries usually works for me. So guys, you might try that next time. Take your wife out, see what most people are thinking when they say, I love you. Michelle, age 9, says, the person is thinking, yeah, I really do love him, but I hope he showers at least once a day. And how to make love endure. Randy, age 8, says, be a good kisser. It might make your wife remember or forget that you never take the trash out. And then Roger, age 8, nailed it right on the head, said, don't forget your wife's name. That will mess up the love. And that would sure enough do it. Well, these kids are age 5 to 10. Let's fast forward the VCR about 5 years, look at another interaction that a mother had with her 15-year-old daughter. Penny Marsh felt like somebody had kicked her in the gut. She'd taken off work early to come home and pack for the family's ski weekend trip in the Poconos. The house was quiet when she entered. No sign of her 15-year-old daughter, Brittany. Penny consulted her watch. Brittany should be home from school by now, she figured. Penny had set her briefcase down by the door, hung her coat in the hall, and climbed the stairs to the second floor. She rapped smartly on Brittany's bedroom door and poked her head into the room. What she saw next knocked the wind out of her. The form of a naked boy rolled off the bed. Penny saw her daughter's nakedness for a moment until Brittany snatched the sheet from up around her feet and pulled it up under her chin. Penny studied the room and speechlessly, panic surging up from her belly in a wave of nausea. The boy's clothes lay in a heap at her feet. She kicked them in the direction of the creature who cowered beside the bed. "Get out!" Penny cried. Her first words echoed shrilly in the room and startled even herself with their venom. "Get out!" she repeated. The boy collected his clothes and clutched them in front of him as he stole past Penny, without a glance in Brittany's direction, and disappeared into the hall. Penny stood trembling in the presence of her oldest child, her 15-year-old baby. She peered at Brittany through swelling eyes, and her daughter would not meet her gaze. An acrid taste filled her mouth, and she fought for control. She quickly lost the battle, however, and clamped a hand over her mouth, whirled, and ran to the bathroom across the hall to throw up. Late that evening, Brittany sat opposite her mother and father in the family room. Brittany and Penny's faces streamed with tears. 42-year-old Gary Marsh fought to control his temper. "How long has this been going on?" Penny asked her daughter. "Matt and I just started going out," Brittany answered. "I don't mean just him. I mean you. Have you been with other boys?" The trio sat in silence for a few long moments until Brittany answered with a long, drawn-out, "Yes." "Oh, sweet Jesus," her mother said, sobbing. "How many?" Gary interjected. "What difference does it make?" Brittany answered, finally raising her glance. "What's the big deal?" "Look, I've never had unprotected sex, if that's what you're worried about." "Okay, never. And it's not like I've slept around, either. You act like it's something to be ashamed of." "Well, it's not. It's a way of expressing love for somebody, okay? What's so wrong about that?" "You lied to us." Penny's face registered pain and astonishment. "Like, what would you have done if I told you?" She mocked her mother's voice. "How did your day go, dear?" "Pretty good. I had sex with Andrew Whitson." "Get real." Gary was standing now, his 6'2" frame towering over Brittany. "How can you sit there and tell me you don't see anything wrong with what you've done? You've been brought up in the church, Brittany Marsh. Hasn't a Christian home done anything for you?" Brittany stood, returning her father's angry gaze. "Yeah," she said, her voice rising in a confident, defiant tone. "It's taught me about love. And that's what this is all about. I love Matt. You can't tell me that's wrong." She stormed from the room. Her father watched her leave, wondering what he should do. Finally, unable to come up with a satisfactory answer, he sat down beside his wife. "She's so young," Penny said. They sat in silence without looking at each other. "She's so young," she repeated. And Gary nodded. "But she's old enough to know better," he said. Penny buried her face into her husband's shoulder and cried. They remained there for a long time, wordlessly sharing their grief, until sleep delivered them from their nightmare. So as we look around society, we don't have to look around very long before we realize that as a society, we've lost our moral direction. And this loss of direction is affecting the church just as it is the society in general. The church may not be as far down the road as the rest of society, but we're heading in the same direction. In the last few generations, there has been a major shift in the minds of many people about the perception of truth and their concept of what truth is. And there are two distinct models of truth. The first model is that truth is defined by God for everyone. Truth is objective and it's absolute. Model two, there on your handout, truth is defined by the individual. Truth is subjective and situational. The first model places God as the center of the universe of truth. He's the source of all things. He's the repository of truth and the ultimate judge of right and wrong. Now, I think most of us would agree that this is true and that this is generally what's taught in most churches. The second model places man as the center of the moral universe. Since the standard of truth is within each individual, it changes from person to person that means it's subjective, and in different circumstances, so it's situational. So each person is the ultimate judge of what is right and wrong. Unfortunately, this is the standard that's being adopted by more and more of our society. Anyone who doesn't believe this just needs to take a look at the approval ratings for the President of the United States following the allegations of his sexual misconduct. And this would be bad enough if it was only affecting society outside the church. But data show that many young people within the church have developed a situational and subjective model for truth. In a survey of 3,795 young people attending youth group meetings from 13 evangelical denominations in 1993 and 1994, done by the Barna Research Group, we see the following sobering statistics. If two people are not married but are in love with each other and were willing, 39% of these kids from these 13 evangelical churches believe that fondling the breast is morally acceptable. 29% of these young people believe that fondling the genitals is morally acceptable. 20% believe that sexual intercourse is morally acceptable if two people love each other even though they're not married. 16% have had sexual intercourse. This is the church. You and I both know that while this survey included only young people, we'd get very similar answers from adults in these same churches. How have we gotten morally so far off base? Well, I want to share some concepts that I've gotten from Josh McDowell's book, Right from Wrong, which I think will help us to understand how we have strayed so far. As God begins to communicate basic truth and morality to us in the Old Testament, He gave us commands. You must not eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil was the first one. Then He gave us the Ten Commandments and many other commands in the Old Testament. And these are precepts. And precepts are the rules and the regulations, codes, and requirements of Scripture. They're only the first step of understanding basic morality. They provide concrete boundaries for human conduct. It was not God's desire simply to leave us with a long list of do's and don'ts, but to lead us from there to larger moral principles. And a principle is a norm or a standard that can be applied to more than one type of situation. It's the fundamental truth upon which the precept is based. Principles help explain the why behind a command. So the principle of reverence for life is behind the precept, thou shalt not kill. The principle of honesty is behind the precept, you shall not give false testimony, or you shall not steal. If we have only God's precepts to guide our lives, we might be inclined to conclude that God's sole purpose in life is to keep us from having fun or enjoying the good things in life. And indeed, that seems to be the attitude that a lot of society has toward God and toward the Bible. But the principles then help us to understand why all the rules and the precepts are there. However, many people don't ever see the principles behind the precepts because they really haven't gotten into God's Word and come to know anything deeper than just all the thou shalt nots. Well, let's revisit the Marsh family, and I think we'll see how this works out. It took some effort, but Penny Marsh was succeeding. She was looking at her daughter Brittany without crying. So much had transpired since last weekend when Penny came home early and discovered 15-year-old Brittany in bed with her boyfriend. Gary and Penny had spent hours crying together, and these days it seemed like a day was not complete without an angry confrontation between parent and child, with Gary issuing ultimatums, Brittany defying them, and Penny crying. The three of them sat in the family room. The younger children, 11-year-old Lauren and 7-year-old Michael, had been sent to play at a neighbor's house. Brittany slumped in the corner of the couch, farthest from her father, who sat in the recliner. Penny took a seat next to her husband on the arm of the recliner. Brittany, I promised you that this wouldn't be like all those other talks we've had, her father began. I honestly don't want to yell at you anymore. Silence descended quickly on the room, punctuated by a sniff from Penny. Gary looked at her. She wasn't crying, yet. I just want some answers, he said. He began to draw his daughter out, asking her many questions. It became a dialogue between father and daughter. How do you feel after you slept with the boy? I don't know. Do you feel guilty? No. Because you don't think it's wrong? No. Sometimes I feel sad. Why? I don't know. They continued. As Penny listened, at times she inspected Brittany's face and features. Her daughter seemed like a stranger to her. At other times she saw her baby, the finely featured dark-haired child who had nestled against her chest in a baby carrier slung over her shoulders. The conversation turned and Brittany was speaking. Why do you think it's wrong? She asked, leaning forward, suddenly becoming interested in the conversation. Gary flashed her a puzzled look. What do you mean? Why is it wrong? If I love Matt, why is it wrong for me to sleep with him? I mean, love makes it right for you and Mom to do it. At least I think you still do it. Why do you think it's wrong for Matt and me? I can't believe this, Gary said. Brittany rolled her eyes. She slumped back against the couch and crossed her arms. Brittany, he answered abruptly, your mother and I are married, and that makes a big difference. Why? She persisted. What do you mean, why? What difference does that make? Gary fidgeted. He was beginning to lose his temper. Because it's wrong. That's what difference it makes. You know good and well that sex before marriage is wrong. You've been taught that all your life, Brittany Marie. Penny, seated beside Gary on the arm of the chair, responded to the anger in his voice by pressing his arm firmly. Look, he said, an edge still surfacing in his voice, some things are just wrong. They just are. Just like I know my name is Gary Marsh. Just like I know which way is up. Some things are just right, and some things are just wrong. And you and I both know that what you're doing is wrong. Brittany's voice rose in reaction to his tone. Well, you may think it's wrong, but I don't. You're entitled to your opinion, and I'm entitled to mine. Just because you believe something different doesn't mean that you're right, you know. This is the 90s. Things are different from when you were a kid. She rose from the couch and began walking out of the room. So the precepts and the principles of Scripture have a deeper purpose than just to guide our lives, although they will do that. And they'll bring us a lot of blessings as we obey them. But a deeper purpose for the precepts and the principles of the Bible is to teach us about the character of God, to help us know the person, God Himself. Moses understood this progression of the precept, principle, person progression when in Exodus 3:13 he prayed, "If you are pleased with me, teach me your ways so that I may know you." He realized that learning God's ways, understanding His precepts and principles, and the principles behind Him would acquaint him with the person of God Himself. And there's kind of a pictorial view of that in your notes there. It says the test of truth. And so as something goes through the precepts, then through the principle, ultimately emanates from the person of God Himself. And King David acknowledged that God's precepts were an expression of His character in Psalm 19, verses 7 through 9. And we might, let's stand up, kind of circulate a little bit. Let's read this together. Okay, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The ordinances of the Lord are sure, and altogether righteous. You have a seat there. So the words that are used to describe God's law, perfect, trustworthy, right, radiant, pure, sure, and righteous, describe God's law because they describe God Himself. So ultimately, truth does not reside in the principles or the precepts of Scripture, but in God Himself. So this is the ultimate test of truth for a particular action. How does it compare with the person of God? Now let's look at how this test of truth applies to sexual purity. In many places in the Bible, God has made His standard clear. sexual involvement outside of marriage is wrong. Acts 15:29 says, abstain from sexual immorality. 1 Corinthians 6:18 says, flee from sexual immorality. And 1 Corinthians 10:8 says, we should not commit sexual immorality. And God has repeated these precepts many times in the Scripture. There are many examples of those who suffered because they disobeyed these commands. King David's sexual sin with Bathsheba led to murder, lying, and death of their baby, as well as unspeakable pain for the two of them. And we'll be looking at that example a little bit more later. So in the Bible, negative commands are not there simply to, quote, keep us from having fun, unquote, as many people believe. For every negative command in Scripture, there is a positive principle. And there are at least three scriptural principles or standards regarding sex. Principle of love, purity, and faithfulness. So the first biblical standard of sex is one of love. Could I get somebody to volunteer to read Romans 13, 9 and 10 for me? Go ahead.
For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there is any commandment, all are summed up in this by saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law.
Okay, thank you. So love is evident in a relationship when the happiness and the health and the spiritual growth of another person is as important to you as it is as your own. Unfortunately, many times we're working from a counterfeit concept of what love is. The second biblical standard of sex is one of purity. Who wants to? Could I get somebody to read 13:4, Hebrews 13:4?
Let the marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge.
Okay, thank you. So God designed sex to be enjoyed in a husband-wife relationship for several purposes. For procreation, Genesis 1:28, for spiritual unity, Genesis 2:24, and for recreation, Proverbs 5:18 and 19. The sexual relationship is meant to be a relationship that a husband and a wife have with one another and with no one else. That relationship or union can be broken even before marriage if one or both of the partners has not kept the marriage bed pure by waiting to have sex until it could be done in the purity of a husband and wife relationship. Okay, then the third biblical standard of sex is one of faithfulness. Who could I get to read Psalm 85:10? Okay, Charles?
Love and faithfulness meet together.
Okay. So in practical terms, the biblical standard of sex requires that a commitment of two people to remain committed to each other. Marriage is central to biblical sexuality because it binds two people together in a lifelong commitment. It's only in this context that love can produce the emotional and physical and spiritual intimacy that God intended for it to produce. And these principles are right because they are from God. They reflect His nature and His character. They pass the test of truth because they reflect the original. And so, first of all, as we look at the original, we see that God is love. Who can I get to read 1 John 4, 8, and 9? Steve?
The one who does not know love does not know God, for God is love. By this love of God was manifested in us, that God has sent His only begotten Son into the world so that we might live through Him.
Okay, thank you. You know, we usually, when we think of God and we think of love, we usually think in terms of God loves us. God showed His love to us, and that's certainly true. But even deeper is that love is not just something God does. Love is something God is. It is the central character of who God is. Okay, secondly, God is pure. Can I get somebody to read 1 John 3:3? Okay?
Everyone who has the hope of glory in Him purifies himself, just as He, God, is pure.
Okay. So God has communicated purity to His people. In the Old Testament, as He gave instructions for building the tabernacle and building the temple and the sacrifices, He demanded pure gold in the building of His tabernacle. He demands pure incense for use in worship. He demands pure animals for sacrifice. He demands pure hearts in Matthew 5:8. He demands pure religion in James 1:27. And pure relationships in 1 Timothy 5:2. Okay, thirdly, God is faithful. Who can I get to read Deuteronomy 7:9? Okay, Charles?
You know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping his covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love him and keep his commands.
Okay, thank you. So even if we're faithless, he, God, remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself. So again, faithfulness is not something God does, but it's something that he is. So all of the actions that we commit, which reflect our problems with maintaining God's standard of purity in our lives, whether it's the physical act of sex outside of marriage, or whether it's impure speech, or viewing impure materials, or anything else, is wrong because it violates God's standard in one or more of these areas. And so, again, on your handout, we have a look at the test of truth. And the precept, flee sexual immorality, is there, and it's based on God's standard of sex, which is based upon love, purity, and faithfulness. And that principle is true because God is love, God is pure, and God is faithful. Now, while all of this is very true, these principles will do very little to convince people who lack moral convictions about sex outside of marriage. But if we can show them and demonstrate to ourselves, too, that truth actually works in the real world, if we can expose people to the evidence of truth, then perhaps they'll acknowledge the truth and change their actions. Many people care less about whether what they do is right or wrong. What they want to know is this going to meet my needs? What's in it for me? And so we need to realize that moral choices are not only right, that is, they conform to God's character, but they're also the surest path to pleasure and fulfillment. In other words, they correspond favorably to reality because they are the surest, because they protect and provide for us. Obviously, it'd be better if we could start with focusing on what's right and corresponds to God's character rather than focusing on our rewards. But the truth is that most of us are simply not at that level of spiritual maturity, and a lot of the people that we'll be dealing with are not. Well, let's rejoin the Marsh family. And I think we'll see a little bit about as Penny or Brittany comes up against some of the sobering consequences of her actions. Brittany climbed the stairs to the second floor. She had expected to find her mom in the living room or the kitchen. It was Saturday afternoon, and she had just arrived home from her high school soccer game. She hoped to borrow a few dollars from her mother so she could go to the mall with some friends. She thought she heard her mother's voice coming from the bedroom. Must be talking on the phone, she thought, knowing that her father was putting in some overtime today. The bedroom door was slightly open. Brittany placed a hand on the door and pushed as she leaned into the room and called her mother softly, being careful not to interrupt the conversation. But her mother was not on the phone. She sat on the edge of the bed with a wad of tissues in her lap and a white trash bag at her feet. Her face was splotched and red, and she choked off a sob as she saw Brittany enter the room. "Mom, what's wrong?" Brittany asked. Penny wiped her face hurriedly and scrambled to gather up the tissues that littered the bed and the floor beside her. Brittany sat beside her mother. "What's wrong?" she repeated. Her mother turned her head then and looked at Brittany like a wounded animal. Her eyes conveyed a mixture of pain and panic that scared Brittany. Penny reached into the plastic bag at her feet. "I found this," she said, her words punctuated with emotion, "when I was emptying the wastebaskets this morning." She pulled out the home pregnancy test that Brittany had used Saturday night. Brittany kicked herself inwardly for not getting the evidence out of the house. She opened her mouth to speak, but met her mother's pained expression only with silence. "Oh, Brittany," her mother cried, and launched into a new round of sobs. Mother and daughter sat wordlessly for many long moments until Penny stifled her emotions, licked her lips, and straightened her back. "I thought," she began. She clenched her jaw as she struggled to gain control. "I thought you said you always used protection." The words were spoken matter-of-factly, with pain but no bitterness. "I do," Brittany replied quickly. Well, she added reluctantly, not always. Her mother nodded seriously. Why didn't you tell me? Her voice was different already, controlled, concerned, like a mother inspecting a bump on her child's forehead. Brittany lowered her eyes and stared at the floor. She shrugged. I don't know, she answered. Her voice quivered. I was just so scared. Penny stretched an arm around her daughter, pulling her close. After a few moments had passed, Penny asked, was it positive or negative? Brittany reached across her mother's lap for a tissue. Negative, she said as she wiped her eyes. After a few moments, Penny spoke again. You know what you felt like when you were worried that you might be pregnant? Brittany nodded. It was awful. My hands couldn't stop shaking. Do you think that's what true love feels like? Brittany didn't move. What do you mean? Well, you felt scared. You felt alone. You had to sneak into the bathroom and go through that experience by yourself. Are those the kind of feelings that you expect true love to produce? Brittany didn't answer. See, Brittany, those are exactly the kind of things God wants you to avoid. That's one of the reasons he tells us to flee sexual immorality. Because he'd rather have you and your husband taking a pregnancy test, waiting hopefully and expectantly for the result, instead of trembling in fear by yourself as you take it. A few more moments of silence passed. Does Matt know? Brittany nodded without removing her head from her mother's shoulder. How did he react to all this? I don't know. He's glad I'm not pregnant, but he's seemed kind of weird lately. It might have scared him, too. Yeah, I guess. A melancholy note sounded in Brittany's voice. So God's standards for sexual purity protect us from a lot of different dangers. First of all, on your hand out there, they protect us from guilt and provide for spiritual rewards. And it also, the blessing of a clear conscience and an unhindered walk with God is priceless. 1 Corinthians 6:13 says, the body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Sexual purity and faithfulness are pleasing to God and rewarding for the marriage partners. Next, God's standards for sexual behavior protect from unplanned pregnancies and abortions. And it also provides a healthy atmosphere for child raising. Every day in the United States, 2,795 teenage girls get pregnant, and 1,106 of them will have abortions. Those who keep their babies face many overwhelming difficulties with their health, continuing their school, trying to raise their child by themselves. Those who choose to abort their child face many long-term problems also. In one study, 72% of the girls that were surveyed who had had an abortion said that they held no religious beliefs at the time of their abortion. But in retrospect, 96% said they regarded their abortion as taking of a life or murder, something they had to live with the rest of their lives. God's standards for sexual behavior protect from sexually transmitted diseases and provide peace of mind. At one time, most sexually transmitted diseases were regarded as simply nuisances that could be cured with readily available treatment. So people thought they could ignore God's laws regarding purity and then go to the doctor and just get it fixed up, suffer no physical consequences. Of course, that really wasn't true back then. There are a lot of emotional consequences. But now there are several sexually transmitted diseases for which there is no cure, either now or any time in the near future. Genital herpes is one of the first to appear. Now we have hepatitis B and AIDS. And while AIDS and hepatitis B can both be transmitted through contaminated blood, most of the cases do occur through sexual transmission. And aside from those two, all the other diseases, sexually transmitted diseases, simply do not occur in a marriage where both partners have been pure prior to the marriage and remain pure within the marriage. It just doesn't happen. And then lastly, God's standards for sexual behavior protect from sexual insecurity and provide for trust. Because sexual immorality is not exclusive, it creates insecurity and jealousy and hinders sexual freedom and sexual and self-expression. there will always be the thought of comparing or being compared with a previous sexual partner. Sexual faithfulness and faithfulness before marriage help to create an atmosphere of trust after marriage, while premarital sexual activity can create concern about the faithfulness in the marriage. So God's standard of sexual behavior then protects us from a lot of physical, emotional, and spiritual dangers. Well, now I want to change pace just a little bit. It's been a real privilege to come down here to Key Man's by myself, and then later on to be able to bring my sons. And so today it's just a real thrill for me to be able to share the podium with my son Keith. And so he's going to come and share some things that God has dealt with him on in the area of purity, and particularly in the area of dating. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Keith.
Thanks, Dad, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to do this, and for bringing me down here so many times. I want to begin with a question to you guys, and Charles, you and Justin, because I got this stuff from Jason. You're exempt from answering these questions. I want to ask you what the most important word in the world is, in your opinion. You can't answer. Does anyone have a word that they might think?
Love.
Love. That's a good one. God is love. His love is what saves us. Because of His love, He sent His Son. But that's not the one that I've got in mind. Does anybody else have another guess?
Trust.
Trust. Without trusting God, we cannot be saved. Without trusting in Him as our Savior. But that's also not the one I have in mind. Does anyone else have a guess?
Purity.
Purity's a good try. That's what this is about. But
Faithfulness,
Jesus, good tries, God. But I'd have to go with the most important word in the world, in my opinion, would be relationship. Why is that the most important word in the world? Because basically, our relationship with God determines the quality of all our other relationships. Our relationship with God determines the quality of all our other relationships. To begin with, to have true life, we need to have a relationship with God. Once we have a relationship with God, we also need to look at the rest of our life. What is your life? Your relationship with your parents as you grow up, with your friends, with people you meet, with your roommate in college, businesses and partners in business, or those who work with you. Your relationships are basically kind of defining in your life. And if we don't have a relationship right with God, it's very unlikely that we can have a relationship that is right with others around us. I believe Satan's goal is to lure us into wrong relationships with God, with our parents, with authorities, and with our friends. Particularly younger guys such as myself and a few others that I see around here, being in the right relationship with God is extremely evident in your relationship with your parents. If you don't know exactly where you are with God, take a look at where you are with your parents. That's usually a generally good way to tell exactly where you are with God. Today's young men and women are being beat down and defeated in a big way through dating relationships. And I've seen this in a lot of my friends' lives, and I've seen it in others, friends of friends, and on extended. But there's a lot of pain, a lot of consequences, bad consequences that are a result out of bad dating relationships. So my question is, what is dating? If you look it up in Webster's Dictionary, you'll find the word date to mean the sweet fleshly fruit of a tall palm tree. Until recently, whoever puts together the dictionary added the meaning that it's a social engagement with persons of the opposite sex. It's something that has come around just in recent years. Used to, when you wanted to get to know a young lady and eventually marry her, you courted her, and you would go and spend time with her parents, her family. She would spend time with your parents, your family. And it was not a one-on-one date relationship as we know it today. It's predominantly an American thing. Most other places in the world, with the exception of perhaps a few European societies, other than that, mostly they still have a practice of parents choosing who their kids will marry. Some parents don't think that's such a bad idea. Josh McDowell tells us, however, that every day in America, at least 1,000 unwed teenage girls become pregnant, just in America alone. 1,106 teenage girls get an abortion. And perhaps one of the most staggering statistics, 4,219 teenagers contract a sexually transmitted disease daily in America. If you want to include those in their early 20s and young adulthood, then these numbers can only rise. Many young men and women feel that in order to be normal, they must date. And this is simply not true. As I've looked around at the dating relationships that I've seen in others, I've only found an encouragement in what I see in them to not date, because I see them hurting each other and getting off into some wrong things because of that date relationship. I encourage you guys who are fathers to encourage your children to follow a different path. There's nothing wrong with not dating. In fact, as we look at dating, I think you'll find that it's best not to date in a one-on-one relationship until a much later point, perhaps even very close to marriage. You don't have to be normal to date. And I can't overemphasize that point. So many of my friends feel like they aren't normal unless they've got a boyfriend or a girlfriend. It's simply not true. And as we look at some of the things, there's actually advantages not to having an exclusive one-on-one dating relationship. I want to draw your attention to the fact that I got a lot of this from the following information from a guy named Joshua Harris in his book, I Kiss Dating Goodbye, which is an excellent book. And don't let the title scare you away that he just totally kissed dating and all girls and everything goodbye. It's actually a really great book, and it takes a real good view that's a non-confrontational view of just taking a good look at dating and what's going on with that. Why are so many people messing up in that type of relationship? He gives us 7 habits of what he calls highly defective dating. The first one is that dating leads to intimacy, but not necessarily to commitment. And in your handout, there are several points under each of these, and I'll just kind of hit a highlight underneath each of these categories. Intimacy without commitment awakens desires, emotional and physical, that neither person can justly meet. In 1 Thessalonians 4:6, we see the word defrauding come up. And basically, Joshua Harris defines that as promising something we cannot or will not provide. You're ripping somebody off in a date relationship. If you're getting intimate without commitment, if you're committing to physical intimacy and you have no thoughts of ever giving them a lifelong commitment of marriage, you're ripping that person off. Dating tends to skip the friendship stage of a relationship. So often I've seen this happen in several of my friends who take off and they kind of get physically attracted to each other, start to hang out, go out on dates, go to a movie, go to a dinner, whatever. And by the time they end up getting sick of each other, which generally tends to happen, they break up. Commitment is defrauding, and intimacy without friendship is superficial. Dating often mistakes a physical relationship for love. Man, I can't tell you how many. This kind of even reiterates the last point in the fact that some of my friends I've seen, they'll get involved physically. And then they'll break up, realize they couldn't stand each other, and shudder at the thought that they would have had to spend much longer together, because not only do they not like each other, but they can't even find a love for each other. They can't find a love in their hearts. And sometimes that's a sad situation, because we know that God gives us the love to be able to even love our enemies. And if you can't find that, then you might be in trouble. Okay. I want to introduce you to something called the law of diminishing returns. Some of you might know or be familiar with what that is. But basically what the law of diminishing returns is anything you do or anything you invest in, the more you do that or the more you invest in it, the less you get back over time. And that's how it goes with a physical relationship when that's the focus. If you begin holding hands with your girlfriend, after a while, that's kind of neat. At first it's, ooh, I got to hold hands with her. But after a while it's, nah, this is nothing. We need to do a little kissing, a little hugging and kissing. And after that, that stuff begins to wear off. The effect of it begins to wear off. And eventually you work deeper and deeper searching for more of that, more of what you get back off of that, off of fulfilling that desire. And God tells us basically that focusing on the physical is plainly sinful. God demands sexual purity, and as you begin to get involved more and more physically, the end result, unless it's stopped, is only sexual intercourse. And he tells us that this before marriage is wrong. Sex is better defined, I believe, as a progression of physical activity. It's not what we often see on a nature show as one quick act of love. One quick act of passion, of fulfillment of desires. But rather, sex begins with holding hands. Because once you begin to hold hands, then you'll want to hug, you'll want to kiss, you'll want to spend more and more time in those kinds of things, and eventually it ends in sexual intercourse. But I believe that it begins much, much earlier than that. And I'd also like to mention that today, as I walk through the halls of my school even, and I go to a Christian school, touching women is no longer done with respect or caution. Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 5:2 to treat younger women as sisters with absolute purity. And he also, in some of his epistles, has said basically it's not good to touch a woman. And I've seen guys anywhere from casual contact to getting more and more serious just with girls that they consider friends and not necessarily their girlfriend. And I believe that there's a sincere lack of respect for women today in society. And I think that we as Christians should be able to raise that standard and say, no, I'm staying away from that because I respect that woman more than to just go up and begin touching her. Dating often isolates a couple from other vital relationships. Several of my friends I've seen, as they got to dating, what they would do is they would spend more and more time with each other, which is natural as you get a deeper relationship with someone. The more time you spend with a friend, the more you want to spend with that person. The more time, for those of you who are married, as you got married, before you got married, I'm sure you realized you were spending more and more time with your fiancé or wife. And as you were, as you get married, that begins to be a constant thought, is her. And what happens, though, when you do that in a one-on-one dating relationship as a young man, what can happen is that you can sever ties with other friends, leaving one high and dry when the dating relationship is over. Yeah, you may have one really good friend and a girl that if you end up breaking up with, you've lost maybe your best friend because basically you've neglected your other relationships to spend time with her. And now, all of a sudden, you find out you've kind of lost contact with the other friends that you did have. And you certainly haven't made many new relationships. Dating, in many cases, distracts young adults from their primary responsibility of preparing for their future. And I can't stress this one quite enough, because as dating, even though dating takes away from your time in other relationships, and one of those relationships, by the way, that is often first neglected is the relationship with God. And the most important relationship then is neglected. And as you begin to do that, you lose some of the training, perhaps, or some of the opportunities for training for future life. We cannot live in the future, but neglecting our current obligations will disqualify us for tomorrow's responsibilities. One of the saddest tendencies of one-on-one dating is to distract young men and women from developing their God-given abilities and skills. Instead of equipping themselves with character, education, and experience necessary to succeed in life, many allow themselves to be consumed by the present needs that dating emphasizes. So instead of taking a mission trip with your youth group, perhaps you stay behind because you can't be separated from your girlfriend for that long. And not necessarily that that is a terribly wrong thing or it's a complete sin or you're condemned because you do it. But you're missing out on a unique opportunity to serve God, to serve others, and to perhaps grow in Him. Also, one of the things that I've tended, that I see as a tendency is basically your schoolwork goes way downhill. People, as they, that's something that a lot of kids, a lot of us, we don't want, necessarily care for. We don't want to do so much of it. It becomes kind of a hassle, and when we have something better to do that we think is better, such as being with a girlfriend, that we've even neglected friendships or God, our relationship with God for, it comes very naturally to neglect studies. And that can be detrimental to your future if you haven't taken those studies and you don't use that time to prepare yourself for a future vocation to support a family. Dating can cause discontentment with God's gift of singleness, and not necessarily that if you, that I'm not necessarily in reference to you are called to be single for the rest of your life, but the fact that God has given us our single years as a gift, where we have no other, we don't have the responsibility of a family to provide for. We don't have the responsibility of a wife to care for. We have the responsibility basically to honor God and glorify Him and work for Him, do His work. And many people that I've seen, their single years are some of the most productive years of their life because they can commit much more time to God's work. And not to say that once we get married that it's bad not to commit that time, but yet God demands that we commit some of that time now to a wife and a family. But that as we are single and we begin one-on-one dating relationships, we begin to neglect maybe some of the God's work that He has for us. And dating creates an artificial environment for evaluating another person's characteristics and their character. One of the examples that Joshua Harris gives that I can actually apply as a personal illustration also is an adjustable basketball goal. If I go outside and I have an adjustable basketball goal, I can knock that thing down to about the height I can reach it. And I can move across that court and dunk that ball like you wouldn't believe. Every time. Forwards, backwards, 360, I've got the dunks. You knock that thing up to 10 foot high, and after I've lowered the standards and made myself look good, you knock it up to 10 feet high, and I'm just a white boy who can't jump. There's no way I'm reaching that goal with a basketball to dunk it. My best might be a layup once in a while. But what happens is we kind of drop our goals down, lower them, and oftentimes, just like one of the little guys in the deal my dad read at the beginning, we lie to each other on that first date so that we look good for the second one, so that we can get a second one. And in doing so, you lower the standards. You don't see their real character. You've lowered your standards to make yourself look good, which God also obviously calls for us not to compromise. But when we focus then on just a friendship, a lot of times we can see their real character for who they are. Basically, you know, I'm not telling you to go to a monastery to remain single forever or not to interact with girls at all, but to concentrate on just being friends. Mr. Harris gives us three basic steps to this and three important things in considering friendship and keeping a friendship away from the intimacy of a one-on-one dating relationship. Understand that the difference between friendship and intimacy, that's the first thing that you've got to do. Friendship is something other than two people in their relationship. Intimacy is about each other. In a true friendship, something outside the two friends brings them together. What we can see is that people who are in a dating relationship are focused on one another and their attraction to each other. And that's something inside themselves. But friends, oftentimes, are focused on something outside themselves, such as common interests and common goals. And it's that way the relationship is not kind of a self-centered, but an outward-centered thing. And oftentimes, it's a lot easier to allow God to be the center in a friendship than in a one-on-one dating relationship. C.S. Lewis tells us that we picture lovers face-to-face, but friends side-by-side. Their eyes look ahead. And also, for as far as friendships go, you should be inclusive and not exclusive. In a friendship relationship, you're not afraid to bring others along to meet a goal or to enjoy a common interest. If you enjoy playing basketball, great. You can get together a group of friends and play. One-on-one gets old after a little while. And you don't want to just have a third wheel. One-on-two doesn't work. You have to have a sincere desire to include others. Bring along four other friends for each of you. You can have a good game of five-on-five. And you can include other people who can then see you can grow in relationships not only to that one person that maybe you're focusing on, which you shouldn't completely focus on, but that one person maybe you've got a little special interest for. But also what you can do is grow in friendships with others, and you don't have to neglect others' friendships and the relationship with that. When choosing and planning an activity, make sure you start with the final goal and not the couple. If you start with the couple, pretty soon it'll be the couple out on a date. If you start with a goal or with a common interest, it's real easy to see others who might be interested in that also and that you can bring along. Also, in doing friendships, you need to seek opportunities to serve and not to be entertained. The late Kurt Cobain, which many of us know as a large member, a very highly member of the band Nirvana, who ended his life by committing suicide. He blew his head off with a shotgun. Obviously, not very content and happy man. He captured the attitude of today's culture with the line, "Here we are, now entertain us." With TVs, movies, and magazines and books and everything you can think of, video games, Nintendo, Sega, whatever you want, this is a society of entertainment. And being entertained is not bad, but if we no longer seek opportunities to serve others and to be a servant to others, then perhaps we need to take a look and evaluate our lives on the basis of what we're doing in our priorities in our life. In serving others is found a deeper friendship. Where do you learn more about someone? Sitting next to each other while watching a movie or serving side by side? In my youth group, we've had in the past several different opportunities to serve the elder people of our church by going and mowing their lawns in the summer when perhaps they're not able to get out and do that. And you can learn a lot more about a person's character when you see them working hard, going through a little strife maybe. Maybe sometimes it's not quite as easy. You can learn a whole lot about a person and how they are by looking at that. And aside from that, you get the added benefit of doing something for God at the same time as growing to know each other. And so basically, in conclusion for the dating part, I don't believe that one-on-one dating is necessary. You can take a group of friends and go out and have just as much fun and avoid some pitfalls and also maybe get some advantages out of that. And the next thing I want to address is the mind, because perhaps the largest area of impurity in our lives is found in the area of the mind. Because we may find it easy with the people that we've surrounded us with maybe to stay away from sexual impurity or sexual immorality. Maybe we haven't, but a lot of times what people do see gives us a little bit of accountability in our lives that we don't want to do that. But our mind is hidden from the sight of all other humans. Unless you choose to reveal it to someone, then no one else has to know what goes on in your mind, at least for a while. After it sinks in, after a while, it will begin to become evident in your life. But because of this lack of accountability for our thoughts, mental purity is probably the hardest for us to maintain. However, God does call us to mental purity as well as purity of the mind and the body. See, the mind is not exempt from God's calls to purity. Matthew 5:16 says, "In the same way, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father which is in heaven." 1 Peter 2:12 says, "As you hold out the word of..." Better look that one up. 1 Peter 2:12, which is an excellent verse that my basketball coach actually made me memorize as a side note while I look it up. Tells us that live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day that He visits us. And in Philippians 2:15, God tells us that we need to become blameless and pure, children of God, without fault in a crooked and depraved generation in which we shine like stars in the universe as we hold out the word of life. See, we are the ministers of the gospel. And when we hold out the word of life, and as we witness to others, our witness can become tainted by our impurities. And that begins in the mind. Let me demonstrate just a little bit of the thought about how that works exactly. If I were to go down to a store or one of the gas stations down here or something and buy you a bottle of water or Coke or Dr. Pepper, whatever you want, whatever you'd prefer, and I gave that to you, you might thank me, drink it, not think much more about it. But let's say I take that same bottle and I go right down here and take it in the bathroom, dip it in the toilet. Now, even if somebody did flush the toilet before that, if you knew that's where it came from, chances are you probably would refuse it and you may not speak to me again. In fact, you'd probably avoid me for the rest of the conference thinking I'm a little weird. But I know this kind of silly illustration that I've made up is a little odd, but the reality of it's very evident if you take a look at the fact that that is played out in our minds every day. See, too often we're presented with a bottle of stuff by this world, and basically all it is the refuse and the waste of this world. Whether it's in the form of going to a movie we don't need to see, watching TV that we don't need to watch, looking at magazines, reading books that we don't need to read. It's all there. And that refuse is presented to us. Except the outcome's a little different. Knowing where it comes from, we still accept it. Gladly sometimes. We take it into our minds, and it becomes a stagnant cesspool of this world's sewage. Simply put, it pours through our minds and pours into our minds through our eyes as we watch certain TV programs, look at certain magazines, or watch certain movies. It gushes in through our ears as we listen to dirty jokes or gossip, and then it stagnates as we apply the time of thought as we dwell on those things. The next thing we know, it sinks to our hearts. And from there, we begin to basically vomit it out of our mouths, onto and into others around us. Luke 6:45b tells us, "For out of the overflow of his heart, his mouth speaks." What you let in your mind eventually makes its way to your heart. And I realize that this is kind of a gross illustration of sewage and refuse, but we need to realize how detestable sin is to God. And when those things are offered to us, the fact that it's offered to us doesn't make it wrong. And it's not a sin for it to be offered to us. But the fact that we accept it, dwell on it, think about those things, look at those pictures, watch those movies, do whatever, that's what's wrong. And that's what begins to seek into our hearts. And the mental area, more than anything, will destroy a relationship with a person of the opposite sex. The more you allow in for that, the more likely you are to fail in that relationship. And I cannot give you the specific application for your life. I don't know what you struggle with. I don't know where exactly your areas of temptation are there. But I think without exception, we could all work in some way on keeping our minds pure. James 1:27 tells us that pure and faultless religion that God our Father accepts is this, basically to look after the orphans and the widows in their time of distress and to keep oneself pure from being polluted by the world. My challenge to you then is to join me in trying to keep ourselves from being polluted by the world so that we can become blameless and pure, children of God, faultless in a crooked and depraved generation in which we shine like stars in the universe as we hold out the word of truth. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. You did a great job. Well, before we go on, won't we all stand up and stretch just a little bit? A lot of this is, at least it is for me, pretty intense stuff. And so maybe we can kind of stretch out. And it's just been such a thrill to see how faithful God has been in the lives of each of our sons to, you know, bring them into Himself and just see how they've responded to God's teaching. And so it's just been real exciting. Isn't God good?
Amen.
Okay, we can have a seat here. What I want to share with you now are just some practical steps how to stay pure in a polluted world. And this is based a lot of this on a sermon our pastor gave us last fall. It had some really good points, and so I asked his permission to share these. But first of all, make a commitment to God's standards. How can the young man, and by the way, this applies to us old guys too, how can the young man keep his way pure? By living according to your word, Psalm 119, verse 9. So every do not in the Bible is God's way of saying, don't hurt yourself. Second, manage my mind. Be careful how you think. Your life is shaped by your thoughts. Keep your mind on what is right. We want purity in terms of what comes into our bodies, like Keith was talking about a while ago, but we're sometimes not all that particular about purity in terms of what comes into our mind. We need to insulate ourselves. And I put down there kind of a little step about how immorality happens. First, we accept a sinful thought into our mind. And at that point, we can send it on, or we can sit there and dwell on it. If we dwell on it, then with the potential for an emotional, non-physical involvement with another woman can begin. That then progresses to physical involvement. Fourthly, to rationalizing our actions, doing things to get ourselves out of trouble. 2 Timothy 2:2, in the Phillips translation, says, turn your backs on lustful thoughts and give your attention to goodness, integrity, love, and peace. Whatever gets your attention gets you. And I referred a while ago to David's immorality with Bathsheba, and I think that's a good case in point to look at David's failure to manage his mind. First of all, as we read this story in 2 Samuel chapter 11, David stayed home instead of being out leading his troops in the field. For some reason he decided he didn't need to go. He wasn't out doing his job. By not being where he was supposed to be, he had removed himself from God's protection. Secondly, he is out wandering around the balcony, look around, saw Bathsheba bathing. At this point, he could have turned his eyes, gone back into the house, take a look at his verse review pack or something like that. A lot of things he could have done, but he didn't. He sat there and looked at her, let that dwell in his mind. At this point, he also could have confessed his sin of lust and turned away, but he didn't do that. Fourth, he used his power and his position to have her brought to him, and then she apparently willingly committed adultery with him. And I was noticing as I was reading that the other day, and one of the footnotes brought this out, that the further along you, as we read the story, Bathsheba is originally introduced by name, by Bathsheba. And thereafter, for the rest of the story, she is referred to as Uriah's wife. So further intensifying the act of adultery. David was not with just another woman. He was with another man's wife. Would have been bad enough if she wasn't married. The other thing that I notice from this, and unfortunately I've noticed from my own activities, is the further we get from sin, I mean, the further we get into sin, the harder it is to turn around and go back. The easiest time for David to have turned around, first of all, was to have been out doing his business to begin with. The second easiest been when he's out on the balcony to turn back at that point. You know, it's kind of like as a spaceship is heading in toward the sun or a large mass, that gravity is going to suck it in. And if you get too close, you've had it. And so we need to fight Satan. I think Gene Ward's used the term, you know, fight Satan from artillery range. Don't try to fight him with hand-to-hand combat, because we're going to lose every time if we do that. The other thing I notice is we see Uriah doing exactly what David did not do. Once you know they'd committed adultery, she turned up pregnant, David's got to figure out some way to cover himself, so he has Uriah come, gives Uriah the day off, says, you know, go home to your wife, and so hoping he would sleep with her, and then when she came out she was pregnant, then it would be thought that it was Uriah had gotten his wife pregnant. Uriah refused to go home and sleep with his wife when his comrades were out in the field. He was a faithful soldier. Unfortunately, it cost him his life. But he did what David did not do and was faithful to his duty. So we need to, again, monitor, manage our mind. Don't let ourselves get sucked in, get too close to sin. Thirdly, monitor your media intake. Proverbs 15:14 says, the fool feeds on trash. Fairly blunt to the point. Keep me from paying attention to what is worthless. I will refuse to look at anything vile and vulgar. So we need to be careful about the magazines we read and the shows and the movies we watch. And all, you know, it's not only the Playboy magazines, but it's also some of the, quote, respectable magazines, you know, that are filled with lust-provoking articles and pictures. You know, may not be totally nude, but they're certainly lust-provoking. For a while, you know, we all like sports, and we subscribe to Sports Illustrated. And as most of you probably know, once a year there's a special issue. It's a little thicker, has some extra pictures in it, called Swimsuit Issue. And once you know, we got to read that issue after my wife took a pair of scissors and edited it. So then it was safe. Somehow that stuff just didn't affect her like it did us. We finally just got tired and quit and dropped our subscription to it. But, you know, watch out. You know, it's gotten to where you really, it's hard to check out the grocery store without blinders on. I mean, just all kinds of trash there. You know, read the label on your loaf of bread or pull out your verse pack or do something. It's hard to get through there with pure thoughts. And then another area that I'll just mention, because I'm certainly not an expert in this area, but, you know, 5 years ago, this probably wouldn't have even been brought up in a seminar like this, but it's the Internet. You know, there are a lot of good things on the Internet. A lot of we can get a lot of information, a lot of Christian websites. And so I've, you know, pulled up a lot of old Christian classics that are hard to get a hold of. You know, there's just a lot of godly stuff on the Internet, but there's also just a lot of trash. And so we have to be very careful how we utilize that if we choose to have it in our home. And I've just copied from a Focus on the Family magazine, you know, 8 ways to protect your family on the Internet. And I'm not going to read all those. I did notice on number 3, it's don't allow use. So there's a typo there. I think that's the way it came out in your handout. That's what it is on my notes here. Use of the Internet after the rest of the family's in bed. I think it's important to have the computer in a family room or place where there's not a whole lot of privacy, so that particularly young men, but you know the rest of us too, we need that protection. Don't have a whole lot of time by ourselves there, but that people are in and out, so that we have an idea of what our kids are looking at on the Internet. Because you don't have to be necessarily looking for trash. Sometimes in looking for other things, the stuff will pop up. And so it's you know, just a lot of good things here. There are some blocking programs that are designed to help block out some of this stuff. I've used one that, and we haven't, I haven't had an opportunity to see what it blocks out really necessarily, but I've heard that, you know, none of them are 100% reliable. I did make a note of one called X-Stop that the American Family Association has endorsed. I've not personally used this. I'm going to look into it. But I think the key thing is that while those things are good, don't rely on them. Nothing is 100% safe because things can get through those. So, again, there's no substitute for monitoring our media intake, monitoring our children's media intake. You know what they're looking at. You know, we don't allow any of our kids to have a TV in their bedroom. Our only TV is in the family room. It's hard enough to monitor it there. Be very selective about the homes of friends who they're allowed to visit. We made a lot of people mad because we wouldn't let our kids go spend the night there. And some of those people were our kids that were mad because they didn't get to go spend the night with people. But the fact is, and unfortunately, even a lot of times people in our church or people in our Christian school, you know, do not have the same standards that we have about TV shows or movies that they watch or, you know, just surfing around on the Internet. And so, and just almost every time we've deviated from that and, yeah, okay, we'll just do it this one time, we've gotten burned. We found out that, you know, they were involved in doing something that we didn't want them to be involved with. So, you know, we always try to make sure that we've gotten to know people that our kids spend the night with or kids have interactions with so that we, you know, are as certain as we can be that those parents' standards are the same as ours. And that, I think that's just real critical in, you know, part of the protection that, you know, God's going to hold us responsible for if we fail to provide for our kids. Next thing is minimize opportunities for temptation. There are three ways to minimize this temptation. First of all, recognize what tempts me. 1 Corinthians 10:12 says, be careful if you're thinking, oh, I'd never behave like that. Let this be a warning to you, for too many of you may fall into sin. And, you know, just one note, you know, as we, even with ourselves, but if our kids, you know, sometimes our kids will say, well, you know, don't you trust us to watch TV or to go over to a friend's house or something like that? And, you know, that's not the issue. It's not a matter of trusting them. It's Satan I don't trust. And, you know, there's one thing that we can count on, and that's what Satan's standards are. And so whether we trust our kids or not is not an issue. It's, you know, the fact that we know Satan is out there and we don't trust him. And so just like I wouldn't trust a 5-year-old to go across a busy highway, again, not because I don't trust him, but I know there's danger out there. Secondly, choose your friends carefully. Bad companions ruin good character. This works just the same for us as it does for our kids. And certainly there are opportunities for us to be around people that don't share our standards in terms of witnessing. But if those people become the friends that we hang around with, then, you know, they're going to corrupt us. You know, you catch disease, you don't catch good health. And so we need to be careful who we're hanging around with. Establish protective guidelines, especially at work. But among you there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality, Ephesians 5:3. And let me read just an excerpt from World Magazine from just last week, that I, after as I was preparing this message, we ran across. In the first week after Calvin Pearson was hired as pastor of the Bay Area First Baptist Church in League City, Texas, he began the remodeling process. He called in a workman, and together, with a drill and a keyhole saw, they cut a hole in his office door and mounted a window. It was a flimsy, hollow-core door, and they had difficulty making the window frame fit. So for a while, it flopped. But it didn't matter, says Mr. Pearson, age 46, that window was important, very important. A little over 4 years later, that window was Mr. Pearson's sole incontrovertible defense when he was accused of having an affair. The accusation was leveled at Mr. Pearson after the removal of a staff member got ugly. Just days after the staff member was given notice, rumors began to circulate. Mr. Pearson had had an affair, according to the rumors, with a woman who had since left the church and the area. The first thing I did when I heard about it was call a meeting of the elders, he said. They began an immediate investigation, and I encouraged that. It was vital that I was able to ask, when could it have happened? When was I ever alone with her? Within a few weeks, the elders cleared Mr. Pearson. You've got to follow the rules, he says. They're simple rules, but your career can depend on them. Even keeping the rules won't make a man immune from accusations, but it will make the accusations easier to disprove, Mr. Pearson knows. When someone accuses you, it's never enough to say, it didn't happen. You must also be able to say, it couldn't have happened. So some of the things that I thought of, and I'm sure you guys are aware of a lot of others, you know, just we need to avoid being alone with a woman, particularly in a counseling situation or if she works under us or is a peer. It's just real critical that we don't spend any significant time alone with a woman where that could give rise to any accusations that something could have happened during that time. Establish an accountability relationship with other men who will be willing to hold you accountable and pray for your protection. I think it's real important to be able to hold one another accountable and have people praying for us and be able to just share these problems. There are, you know, a lot of people we really can't share these problems with. You know, if we share these problems with guys out in the world, they're going to laugh at us. This is just part of life. I mean, they see that as an opportunity, not as a danger. And so I think it's just real critical to do that. I have a friend that travels, and he's in an accountability group. And one of the standards that he holds himself to that, you know, we ask him every couple of weeks when we get together is, did you turn on the TV when you're in the hotel by yourself? And I can't remember his answer ever being yes. So, you know, but I think that's probably helping because he's going to know when he comes back he faces us, and we're going to ask him because he's asked us to ask him. And so I think it's important to be accountable to one another and to... And, you know, this may seem silly, but, boy, if you get caught in the middle of one of these things, boy, we'll sure wish to look back and wish I had been accountable. I wish I'd have taken some precautions here, even if we're totally innocent. You know, there's a lot of these things are difficult to disprove if we've left ourselves open where there's even the hint of an opportunity that it could have happened. And our ultimate protection in this area comes from God. You know, He's our ultimate protection. And, yes, accusations may come our way. But God does expect us to use the opportunities that He has provided for us for escape and protection. And, you know, I think the example of Joseph, you know, every time he, found himself caught, you know, he escaped. He still, wound up getting in trouble. And this, as we saw, was God's training program for him. But he did stay pure. And so I think that we need to do everything we can do to just see to it that there's no opportunity in our lives for an accusation, or even worse, an opportunity for us to take advantage of a woman and get involved with another woman. Maintain your marriage. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love. A husband should not deprive his wife of sexual intimacy, which is her right as a married woman, nor should the wife deprive her husband. Do not cheat each other of normal sexual relations, or you'll expose yourselves to the obvious temptation of Satan. So God has given us sexual relations in the marriage to draw us closer together as well as for mutual pleasure. And as with every other gift God has given us, we have to use it in a loving way. This means that my goal in my sexual relationship and with my wife is to meet her needs, not to focus on my own. And as both of us seek to meet one another's needs, then this creates a greater closeness in our marriage, and Satan will have less opportunity to tempt us with an affair. To use sexual relations as a weapon to get what we want is sinful and is a prescription for disaster. But no matter how dissatisfying, guys, our sexual relationship and marriage may be, it is never a justification for us to step outside that relationship into adultery. Again, we can rationalize all kinds of stuff, but that doesn't make it right. Magnify the consequences of sin. Anyone who commits adultery doesn't have any sense. He's just destroying himself. Immorality may cost you your life, Proverbs 6:27. God will judge the sexually immoral. In the area of sin is where Satan really earns his name as the deceiver. Satan will tell us that it won't hurt to dabble in a little innocent flirtation or spend time looking at just a few pictures. The reason he's so successful in deceiving us in this area is that, first of all, sin's fun. There will be some initial satisfaction and enjoyment, but when we sin. And secondly, every sin doesn't always bring about an immediate negative consequence. But one thing is sure, the more we nibble around the edges with sin, the easier it is to take the next step and get further into sin. We need to develop the ability to clearly visualize the end result of the road where these little sins could lead us. You know, we need to visualize the divorce that could result from an adulterous affair that just begins with what we think is a little innocent flirtation. We need to visualize the pain in the lives of children when their worlds turn apart, you know, by a divorce. When we hear about a disgusting case of child molestation, particularly by a trusted family member, and that's where most of it occurs, we need to realize that these cases began with involvement in pornography in most cases. Next time we feel the urge to consider sexual involvement outside of marriage, just kind of visualize the last picture you saw of somebody dying of AIDS. You know, that's what Satan doesn't want us to do. That's what the movies don't show us. They show us, you know, people just sleeping around and having no consequences. They don't show the end result of all these. Well, you know, what do we do? All of us are going to fail in these areas at some point or another, whether it's physical acts or whether it's just acts in our mind or whatever. And, you know, in God's eyes, it really doesn't matter. I mean, it's all sin and it's all immorality. Obviously, the consequences will differ, and we certainly want to stay away from the consequences and not hurt people. But, you know, what, the pathway back to purity, how do we get back to purity when we find that we failed in these areas? Well, first of all, we need to repent. You know, and David says, "Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me." We'll never be able to start back on the road to purity until we agree with God that what we have been doing is sin and purpose to turn away from it. Secondly, receive forgiveness. Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. I said, "I'll confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin." And then, you know, we need to remember that God's forgiveness is a matter of a promise to God, to us from God. It doesn't depend on our feelings. Forgiveness of genuinely confessed sins is just as sure as the salvation of a man who sincerely asked Christ into his life, whether we feel like it or not. And then secondly, you know, we are called to receive God's forgiveness. We are not told to forgive ourselves. Sometimes we don't feel forgiven till we have forgiven ourselves, and God didn't call us to do that. Now, I will note that there is a difference between receiving God's forgiveness and obliterating the consequences of our sin. And receiving God's forgiveness does not take away the consequences of our sin. The girl is still pregnant. There's still a baby. We are still HIV positive. Those things don't go away because God has forgiven us of our sins. David received God's forgiveness for his sin, his adultery with Bathsheba, but the baby still died. Uriah was still dead. There was still a blot on